do enjoy a good cup of tea, but I will I'll either take a sip maybe or we'll just...
Sure.
But I'm fine right now.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so today is the 10th of October, 2015. This is an interview with John Israel. We are on campus. We're in the Lowell Center at UW-Madison, and my name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. John, as I said, for sound quality purposes, I'm going to ask you to say your name and spell your last name.
Okay, my name is John Israel, full name John Warren Israel. My last name is I-S-R-A-E-L.
John, we have perfect sound. So
good.
You speak, I might get it just a touch closer, but you don't need to speak up. I probably will speak up a little bit, so don't think I'm yelling at you. I just want to make sure my questions get on the
okay.
recording.
Well, Troy, before we start, I just want to tell you the last time I checked out sound equipment like this, I was working for WHA. Is that the name of it? Does it still exist?
Mm-hmm.
And we had a there's somebody who whose name should appear in your oral history program because he was a great station. I don't know what his title was, but he was the chief announcer. A guy named Ken Oast. Have you ever come across that name? O-H-S-T, as I recall. And what I remember best about him is that, you know, in that era of radio, if you were doing radio, you had to sound like the voice of God coming from Charlton Heston.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ken Oast, he spoke like this, you know, and I never did any more than, you know, sort of do station identifications during music events. I never got very far in that particular thing. But at any rate, that's a little corner of the university during the 50s that you might be interested in.
Right, and it's interesting. We were talking earlier about how what you remember and what you don't, and
exactly.
what sometimes just having something in front of you will remind you of.
Of course.
All right, so as I said, the first question I was going to ask you, John, which will lead into some of the topics, is why come to University of Wisconsin?
Right. Well, I was a 16-year-old high school sophomore in a town called Woodmere, W-O-O-D-M-E-R-E, Long Island in Nassau County, just over the Queens Line, about 20 miles from downtown Manhattan. And a largely Jewish community. And I was academically very successful and socially quite awkward, and maybe not unusual for a 16-year-old kid in high school. When my father, I think it was, said to me one day, John, there's an article in the New York Times about some kind of experimental program sending 16-year-old kids to college. And if you're interested in it, you have to go, I guess Mineola was our county seat. It's probably in Mineola, but if not one of the places in Nassau County. You want to go and take the scholastic aptitude test to see whether you would qualify for it. And I was interested, and I went and took it. And there were four universities participating in this program in the beginning. The program, just briefly, I think other people in your project, I think Louise Trubeck has probably told you about it, but just to recapitulate, it appeared in 1951 that Congress was going to pass a Universal Military Training at Age 18 Act. And that would have meant that every young American male at age 18, regardless of whether he was in high school or wherever he was, would go into the military without exception for 2 years of training. Well, the Ford Foundation panics easily, and so they panicked, and other people panicked. The University of Chicago had always admitted 16-year-olds who were qualified, but maybe not until they had graduated from high school. But at any rate, Wisconsin, Chicago, Yale, and Columbia agreed to participate in an experiment financed by the Ford Foundation to see whether 16-year-olds who had completed at least 2 years of high school could go to college successfully. So that's what the program was all about. And I was actually in Crater Lake, Oregon, on something called the Rolling Youth Hostel trip that summer. And I had one phone call home during the summer because a long-distance call was a big deal in those days. And I called home, and I found out I was going to the University of Wisconsin. Now, choosing the University of Wisconsin was an interesting process because my main consideration was I felt that this little Jewish ghetto, this upper-middle-class Jewish ghetto in Woodmere, was confining. And I wanted to get as far away from that milieu as I could. So I looked at the colleges. Columbia was just not even in the running. That was too close to home. I figured Yale was a little bit close to home, too. My father was a small businessman who used to make business trips to Chicago, and as a loyal New Yorker, he always said that Chicago was just an ordinary city trying to pretend it could compete with New York. So I had an anti-Chicago animus, so I didn't even think about Chicago. That left Wisconsin, and Wisconsin, of course, was terra incognita, but just the very image of Wisconsin suggested that it would be about as far away from my origins as I could possibly get. There's one more interesting thing. My uncle, a man named William Schumann, was a prominent American composer. I think at that time he was the president of Juilliard, ended up as president of Lincoln Center. At any rate, he said, "John, I got an honorary doctorate from the University of Wisconsin, and the place looks very good to me." So it was all of these considerations capped off by a recommendation from Uncle Bill that finally landed me in Madison.
So you had never been there before until you matriculated there?
I don't think I had ever been west of the Hudson. Oh, well, yes, of course, this rolling youth hostel trip. I had been all over the country on a bicycle. That's another story. But no, I had never been to Wisconsin before.
So what were your, or what do you remember your first impressions were once you got here?
Oh, well, that's a good question, because I don't recall an overall impression. One traveled mainly by train in those days. Took the train to Chicago, and then I guess it was the Chicago-Milwaukee line up to Madison. We were very fortunate. There were 52 of us in that class of Fords. We were very fortunate. The university apparently had looked for an appropriate advisor for us as soon as we were selected. And they found a man named Herbert Howe, others who you may have interviewed, including Louise Trubeck, have probably told you a bit about him, but you've got a Henry Wirtis on your project too. But Herbert Howe was a wonderful guy, and I gather, speaking to people recently, that he was chosen partly because he had taught in a prep school at one point, and I think they had him kind of identified as a Mr. Chips type, and he was. And so he took it upon him. He was connected, by the way, to the ILS, Integrated Liberal Studies program, too. So he recommended to all of us that we seriously consider ILS when we came here. And I think he was thinking about having a little Gemeinschaft inside of the Gesellschaft, a little community inside of this burgeoning university, which had a horrible thing to consider at this point, 13,000 students in those days, which was intimidating. And so he recommended Integrated Liberal Studies. But Howe's initial contribution was to find us a place to live, because we had been chosen in the middle of the summer. The dorms were all full. The university was still suffering from a post-World War II housing shortage. You probably know about the Quonset huts and everything, but that was a period. So he pounded the pavements of Madison during the heat of summer to find room for 52 students. A few of my friends, Charlie Holbrow, was not too far away. He was in Columbus, Ohio. His father drove him up to find a place. But I think almost all of us thanked Herbert Howe. And what Herb did was to try to room us with people as far away from where we came from as possible. So I was fairly early in the alphabet. I was an I from the New York area. And he found a guy named Stephen Kresge, who was from Berkeley, California. So I was fortunate, both in a personal way and in a geographic way, to meet who is a lifelong friend of mine now, Steve Kresge, that way. But because Wisconsin had no geographic quotas, which of course were still present in the Ivy League, and it was an anti-Semitic kind of institution to keep Jews who came disproportionately from New York out of their place. Wisconsin either had no quota or had a much looser quota. I'm not quite sure what it was. But at any rate, because of that, Wisconsin apparently chose us mainly on our SAT scores and things. And the New York area had some outstanding high schools that could outcompete most places in the country, including the Bronx High School of Science in the Bronx and Stuyvesant High School in Brooklyn. So we had a huge number of kids from the New York area. And Herb said that by the time he got past the middle of the alphabet, not only couldn't he room people from the opposite coast together, he said he had a hard time finding people from different boroughs of New York to room together. So our class was disproportionately from the New York area. Not from suburban New York, as I was, but largely from the five boroughs of New York City. So Steve Kresge and I were placed in a room. There was a nice lady named Mrs. Harkins, I think it was Lucy Harkins, on North Lake Street. And the number that pops into mind is 221, but you can check it out. It was just a few doors south of University Avenue. But at any rate, these old Victorian houses, which I understand are collector's items today, were just ordinary rooming houses then. And I suspect that a lot of the landladies were World War II widows, but that didn't dawn on me until recently. I said, why would, you have a woman, a single woman in middle age running a rooming house during that era? And I think that's probably what she was. But at any rate, that's where I lived when I got here. And my initial impression of Wisconsin, I don't recall having an initial impression of Madison or the university as such. I got impressions of different pieces of it. Impression of Randall Stadium, impression of the Ratskeller, that kind of thing, but not of the place as a whole.
Okay. So, John, let us then sort of progress down our topic list here. And so I want to make sure you have space to talk about which, as you call it, sort of the worm's eye view of the Ford Scholar experiment. Is there more you want to say about that?
Well, yeah, because it's an experiment that died young. They were, because of several factors, one, Congress never passed that law, so you didn't have universal military training at age 18 for all young men. I went home for the summer at the end of my freshman year, and I went to see Mr. Pringle, who was the principal of our high school. And I said to him, "Mr. Pringle, I've come to see you because I've had the most remarkable experience at the University of Wisconsin, and I hope that you will recommend this program to other people." And he said, "Well, we are all against it. We meaning the high school principals, we're all against it." And and I said, "Why?" He said, "Because we don't want to lose our brightest students." So that's a second reason that the program, this is just my guess, a second reason the program never continued past the experimental state. The third reason, I think, is because the high schools found another way to accommodate academically bright students, and that was through the college equivalent courses. What is it called? Advanced placement. Yes, advanced placement courses. But for whatever reason, it never continued. Although, from the perspective of those of us at the University of Wisconsin, I don't think there's much doubt that it was not only an academic success, it was a social success, successful in many ways. I'll tell you one anecdote to illustrate a problem that we all had when we got here. We're all 16-year-old boys. With the exception of a few people, I ran into one of my fellow alumni I had dinner with last night, said I wasn't even 16. He said, "I was 15 and a half. I was 5'2" and my voice hadn't changed." He said, "I didn't date for 4 years here." Well, I wanted to date. Not that I'd ever dated very much in high school, but I of course I wanted to date. So And all of us wanted to, but it was embarrassing because what self-respecting 18-year-old girl, we didn't call them women in those days, what self-respecting 18-year-old freshman girl wants to date a 16-year-old kid? Fortunately, the state of Wisconsin had decided that too many people were borrowing IDs to drink in bars, and so they decided to issue a plastic laminated official ID from some state bureau. And you needed a birth certificate in order to get one. Well, that was my opening, because I knew that New York State issued two types of proofs of birth. One is a photostat certificate, which I didn't want. The other is called a certification of birth, which was written out with ink on wavy lined kind of check paper. And I ordered three of those so I'd have room for error, and got the most sophisticated ink eradicator set I could buy, and changed 1935, which was the year I was born, to 1933. It ran a little bit, and so I put a fixative on it and went over everything on the certificate in India ink. By the time I was through with this, it looked even more official than the original certificate, and I proudly walked down to the state office with this thing, and 2 weeks later I had a laminated plastic card saying that I was 18 years old, born in 1933. Now, of course, young women didn't ask us for IDs when we asked them out, but I was able to take my dates to bars, and that was proof enough. And so I also had one more contribution to our little sort of underground project to sneak under the radar of age, and that was that I decided that we needed a kind of a code name for the Ford students so that in public we could talk about our identity without revealing who we were if we wanted to hide it. Not everybody wanted to hide it, by the way, but a great many of us did feel this way. So I said, Ford sounds like fjord, and you find fjords in Norway, so why don't we call ourselves Norwegians? So we passed, at least some of us did, as Norwegians. So that's just a little episodic bit of what it meant. But we all adjusted one way or another. Charlie Holbrow, who is here, married Mary Ross from Cambria, Wisconsin, not far from here, a Welsh community. She was an ILS with me, and I asked Mary yesterday, I said, well, did you know that Charlie was 16? She said, hell, I was present at his 16th birthday. So some people didn't try to hide it, but at any rate, that was, you know, one of the challenges that we had to meet, however we chose to do it. So that's part of a worm's eye view of the program. A lot of things could be said. Herbert Howe took a hands-off attitude toward us. He didn't give us a lot of gratuitous advice. We didn't have to go to see him periodically. He didn't tell us to go into ILS. He just recommended it. Some of us did, some of us didn't. But he had us over in groups, small groups, for Sunday dinners. And I remember Mrs. Howe, Eve Howe, fixed roast lamb, and we all enjoyed a roast lamb dinner, except Herb had an ulcer. Whether because of us or not, we don't know. But he had an ulcer. He ate milk toast, and the rest of us dined on roast lamb in little groups at his house every Sunday. And I don't know how long this went on, because the Ford program had 4 years in it. The first 2 years, the first year there were 52 of us, there were 48 the second year. The third year, young women were also included in the program, and I think there were about 30, and I think probably about 30 the fourth year as well. There may have been 150, 160 people passed through this program altogether, and I think Sunday lunch for groups of Fords probably became a little bit too much for Eve, if not for Herb. So, but at any rate, it turned out, you know, I think the overwhelming majority of us were extremely happy with the results of this program, academically, socially, and just in terms of growing up a little bit earlier.
Great. So the second thing on your list was the Daily Cardinal.
Yeah, the Daily Cardinal was a wonderful experience, and I was trying to think of how I got involved in the Daily Cardinal. For the life of me, I cannot remember. But it could have been through John Hunter. John Hunter was one of the principal reporters for the Cap Times. The Cap Times still publish?
Yes.
Yes, good. Okay.
Once, it's morphed into a once, it's a weekly now.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that. But at any rate, John Hunter, somebody gave me an introduction to him because I remember going to his house for dinner, and he would often show up at the Daily Cardinal as kind of an elder statesman. He must have been in his 30s at that point, helping us out and running us through the operating side of journalism. And so I went there as a volunteer, copy editor, reporter, whatever I did. I rose to university editor or assistant university editor, sort of like a city editor, by my junior year. And then I was part of a clique that ran the Daily Cardinal, and I was the anointed expectant editor for my senior year. But the Cardinal board, in its wisdom, they probably were right, decided I was not really the right person to be editor of the Daily Cardinal. And so I dropped out of the Cardinal. I was in a fit of indignation when I was not made editor, and went on and got good grades and went into the academic world, which was a good thing. But at any rate, working on the Cardinal was wonderful experience in a number of ways. For one thing, of course, it was a great way to get to know the university. I mean, we found out what was going on. There were a lot of very interesting people there. The most prominent person who was there during my period was Richard Schickel, who became a very prominent film reviewer for Time Magazine, nationally known film reviewer. Gerald Schechter became a journalist, I think, for the U.S. government, wrote a book after he spent some time in the Soviet Union with his family. He was another one. Stanley Zuckerman also, I think, became a government journalist. But at any rate, a number of very good people wrote for the Daily Cardinal. I had a girlfriend who worked there. I guess I met her there. So it was a great experience. I learned how to write at the Daily Cardinal. I won't say that the writing course I took here was no good. I don't remember it very well, but I know that everything I know about writing now, and friends often ask me to edit their stuff because I remember all the principles of tight, journalistic writing, which has served me well for my entire life. Another interesting thing about the Cardinal is that in the 50s you didn't have this alienation of students from the university as an institution that you got in the late 60s. We were very supportive of the university, and every year, for example, we would have a special budget issue. When the university tried to get its budget through the state legislature, I gather that issue has the problem has not disappeared today. But at any rate, we would take that issue down to the legislature. I can recall going through, I don't remember which house of the legislature it was, and putting a copy of that early in the morning on the desk of every legislator, so that they would know what the universities, what the position, what the problems were as we saw them. The Cardinal was independent in those days. And one of the things that we had to face was financing the newspaper. We had to finance it through subscriptions. And I can recall knocking on the doors of my professors, trying to get them to buy subscriptions to the Daily Cardinal. A couple of years after I left, it became part of the School of Journalism. Does it run out of the School of Journalism today?
From what I know, yeah.
Yeah.
I think there might also... Yeah, I don't know if it's journalism exactly, but I know they get fees from... probably from journalism as well as student segregated fees probably to help run it.
Yeah, but at any rate, we were completely independent. We were off campus. The Cardinal office was on the south side of University Avenue, just a little bit. What direction is the Capitol from the university? east or west?
Eastish.
East. Well, okay, a couple, several doors east of Park Street, and next to an Italian joint called Paisano's, where we would go for a pizza and what was the gut rot beer that we used to drink? Chianti was a gut rot beer in those days, and you would drink it first because it was cheap, and second because they came in these beautiful straw basket covered bottles, which you could then put candles in and pretend that you were in the cast of La Boheme. Mm-hmm. So, but at any rate, the whole Cardinal experience was just extraordinary. And, I mean, because I don't remember everything I did when I was here. But I remember going down to the Cardinal, and we learned how newspapers worked. One member of the editorial staff had to stay up until about 2 in the morning because our line of type operators were in the back room, and we would go in the back room and read impressions, the printouts of the paper as it came off the linotype machine to make sure that the copy was all accurate. You know, so you learned everything about the running of a newspaper. It was a fantastic experience.
Great. John, I'm going to turn this down just a touch.
Okay, fine.
You are.
I know. I do not need amplification.
You do not need amplification, okay. No. So let's then just move to the next topic on the list. As I said, I reserve the right to maybe do a follow-up interview if there's,
sure,
if there's
sure.
questions well, that after I listen to this again. But the third topic on the list was your work in the Human Relations Committee.
Yeah, well, I don't remember a good deal of that, so Troy. So we can. I'll just tell you briefly. The Human Relations Committee, I believe, was a committee of the Student Council, and how I got involved, I do not remember, except that my politics were sort of mainstream liberal. I mean, and this is worth noting because there are a lot of Jewish guys and women from the New York area, as I am, who came here and were part of the radical politics scene. There's been a lot written about it. You've probably seen some of this literature. I knew these people, but that was not my political background. Insofar as I had any politics, I was pro-civil rights, pro-civil liberties. I was kind of an ACLU liberal, which I still am today in some ways. So that's probably why I got involved in the Human Relations Committee. And the only issue that I can recall us dealing with was something called the 1960 Clause. And I think the university passed this law before I came on the scene, but probably not too long before, because it was a very hot issue when I came here. The university said to the Greek organizations, look, if you have discriminatory clauses in your charters based on race, religion, whatever, they've got to be out by 1960 or we will no longer recognize you. We'll throw you off campus. Well, the fraternities and sororities fought this bitterly because they claimed that they didn't really have power over this. They said, look, these are our national organizations. We don't like these, whether they really did or not. That's what they argued. We don't like these clauses, but what can we do about it? We're creatures of our national organizations. So this was a furious debate. Well, the Human Relations Committee was on the side of the university. We thought that these clauses had to go. And the only thing I can recall doing, we had a retreat every year, where I don't remember, but we went off on our retreat and we invited people from the Interfraternity Council or whatever it was to go on the retreat with us to have what we would call today a dialogue. I don't know what we called it then. And as I recall, the fraternity people were much more politically savvy than I was. And before our retreat was over, they had had a vote on this, and the vote was against the 1960 clause. So in terms of, so far as that went, it was not a successful political ploy. But at least we spoke to each other in what I presume was a civil way for a weekend, which you know, probably not a total waste of time. But Louise Trubeck, whom you've also interviewed in this project, was apparently my, if not my immediate successor, at least she was head of the Human Relations Committee a little bit further down the line.
Okay.
So more than one Ford doing this sort of work.
Right. John, do you know where these, just because I'm interested in location on campus, do you know where these committee meetings were held?
In the Union, if I recall. Okay. Where in the Union? It wasn't in the Ratzkeller. I think we had a little room somewhere in the Union.
And since we're on location, let me go back. Because I'm not sure. Okay, yeah, never mind. You listed the number in the street where you lived. Did you live in that place the entire time you were here?
Yeah, that, you know, 221 is, that's not the right address. I think that was the address. 221 North Mill Street was the address of the Rochdale Men's Co-op, where I lived later. That's something else we can discuss, I think, whenever you want to do
it.
Well,
since we're on sort of location, why don't we talk about that then?
Okay, well, I saw a good deal of university housing when I was here, because we lived within Mrs. Harkin's rooming house for, I think, our first semester. And then Kresge and I, not that we didn't like it there, but we just wanted to see what dorm life was like. So we moved into the dorm, and we lived there for a semester. And then Charlie Hobrow said we roomed for a semester, and then I moved to Langdon Street and roomed with a guy named Chuck Stevenson, who is another member of our Ford group, in a one-room apartment on Langdon Street. And then for my last 2 years, I lived in Rochdale Men's Co-op. Oh, well, it was 221 North Mill Street. And that was one of three co-ops here. We had the Rochdale Men's Co-op, the Groves Women's Co-op, and the Green Lantern Eating Co-op, which was located in the basement of Groves. It was a block up the street, a block up North Mills on the corner of whatever cross street it was from Rochdale Men's Co-op. And I think from what I've read about Groves, I think Groves was a much more politically and socially conscious kind of co-op. I mean, they attracted, you know, people who were on the radical left or into human rights or into this or into that. Rochdale was a pretty practical. I think most of the people who lived there were looking for a cheap place to live. And I don't remember how much it cost, but I'm sure it didn't cost very much. But it was also nice because we ran our own place. You know, there was nobody in charge. There were no adults there. I remember we held our own meetings deciding what to do. We didn't have to worry about the mortgage on the house. I think we had a godfather in the university. May have been Harold Groves, after whom Groves was named. I think was in the economics department. But there were people in the university, on the faculty, who were very supportive of the co-ops and sort of looked after us. But I don't remember dealing with them very much. But at any rate, Rochdale was a fun place to live because I met a great variety of people. There was one other Ford student, a guy named Phil Ebersole, living there, who does a blog now and is a journalist. There are a lot of Wisconsin people there, so I met a great variety of in-state people, non-Ford people of all sorts. There's a Navy veteran I remember named Jim Scott. His brother, who was a Navy ROTC, I think, was named Ron Scott. There's a guy who went to work for the Red Cross named Bob Foyles. Andy Gregg, who was a Daily Cardinal photographer, an Army veteran, lived in a suite of rooms that I co-occupied. So it was a good way to live, you know, and you met a lot of interesting people, and I ate at the Green Lantern for at least one semester. Hmm. So, you know, it was part of living. So, by the way, students at that time, we were classified pretty much by our residence. If you were either a fraternity man or a dorm man or a GDI, a goddamned independent, I was a GDI, and Rochdale was simply a subcategory. The co-ops were a subcategory of GDI. But insofar as there was a counterculture, we didn't even have that term, of course, but, the people on the, political left, or into folk music, or into the peace movement, or, you know, whatever, counterculture kinds of people, you know, we tended to live in that milieu, so we did.
So maybe speaking of that, I don't think it's on your list, but actually it is, student folk music.
Student folk music, yeah. I don't know a lot about that. I never learned to play the guitar very well, but I'm a singer, and so we had a Friday evening sing-in. I don't think we called it that, but just a folk music get together. And what I remember best, Troy, about the folk music is what it was not. It was not a social statement about any issue in the 50s. I don't remember that we had any songs about McCarthyism, about the Cold War, about anything. I don't think any of the songs we sang originated any more recently than the Depression. And all of the songs I can remember were kind of labor songs like the IWW, the International Workers of the World, wobbly songs, Depression songs, Woody Guthrie, we had some Woody, and Spanish Civil War songs. So there was a wonderful disconnect between the songs we were singing and the situation we were in. I mean, we were, all living in the 1950s, and yet there wasn't a single folk song about the 50s that we ever sang. I don't know how much of a folk music scene there was beyond our little group, but I do remember going to hear a concert by Pete Seeger, which apparently was important for various ways. I've read about this in some of the literature from that time, but that was when I first heard Pete Seeger sing, and of course he became a hero of mine, as he was of many people from that generation.
Mm-hmm. So besides that Seeger concert and besides the Friday Friday evening sing-ins, were there other? Do you recall attending other musicals?
I don't think I was a great concert goer. I've always been a classical music buff, and I think I developed. I don't even remember what kind of classical music I heard, except that the Pro Arte Quartet. I understand that the present generation of the Pro Arte Quartet is still here, mm-hmm. but at any rate, I became very much enamored of chamber music, and the most moving concert I ever heard from the Pro Arte. One of my professors, one of the very famous professors of that period, was a man named Hans Girth, who, along with C. Wright Mills, translated Max Weber into English. And Girth's wife committed suicide, and we all went down to the memorial service, and the Pro Arte Quartet played Death and the Maiden. So I remember them best from that particular time, but I don't remember much about folk music culture beyond our little group. And as I said, the thing that impresses me most, and I think it's an important thing if you're looking at things that make a statement about that era, is that there were no contemporary folk songs from that era. It was a little bit pre-Tom Lehrer. You know Tom Lehrer at all?
No.
Join in the folk song army. Mm-hmm. Every one of us cares. Okay. We're all against poverty, war, and injustice, unlike the rest of you squares. Okay, well, but that was when I was in graduate school. That wasn't in the early 50s.
Okay. John, another thing you wanted to talk about was something you've mentioned a couple of times in this interview, and that's ILS, or Integrated Liberal Studies. So wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, well, again, I got involved in this through Herbert Howe, and I probably, like everything else, when I first arrived at the university, I had, no idea what it was, or, only a faint idea of why I might want to be interested in it. But it was wonderful in a sense in that it saved me the trouble of having to decide what courses to take. I had broad liberal education kinds of interests, and this seemed to fit the bill. So I don't recall ever thinking twice when Howe told us about this program. I immediately signed up for it. As I recall, there are about 200 students in it. It was a two-year program. It was integrated in the sense that in the social sciences, the humanities, and the natural sciences, you had a two-year sequence in each one of those areas. And it was integrated in the sense that they tried to interrelate their courses within each year's curriculum. Now, how they did that and to how successfully they did that, I don't remember, and I'm not sure. But the most memorable course that I ever took in ILS, and I think one of the courses you interview people from ILS of that period and ask them about courses. We all remember Greek and Roman civilization because that was the first humanities course in our sequence. And it was taught by two professors, one named Walter Agard and the other named Paul McKendrick. And Walter Agard was, I guess, he was somewhat older, probably in his, maybe in his 50s or 60s. McKendrick, I guess, was in his 30s or early 40s. And Agard did Greece, and McKendrick did Rome. But the beautiful part about it was there was a kind of a dialectic between them, because Agard was a kind of a humane, a humanistic, a Greek, and he played the role, and it was what he was. And McKendrick was kind of a tough-minded Roman, you know? And so they even had at least one session in which Agard and McKendrick had a joint lecture in which they played the kind of Greek values and Roman values off against each other. And it was an eye-opener. It was a revelation. You know, I mean, my God, I had taken a couple of years of Latin in high school, but I didn't know anything about Greece and Rome. It was just the most exciting thing. So that was the very first semester I was here. But the thing that was great about integrated liberal studies, first of all, there was a significant subgroup of Ford students. And so these were my affinity group, both through the Ford program and through ILS. And second of all, again, it was a Gemeinschaft within the Gesellschaft. It was a small community within this, we didn't have the term multiversity, but if we had, we would have used it, in this great, anonymous mass of students. This was something you could identify. We had our own picnics. I don't remember what else we had. I remember we had a dinner at the end of our 2 years. It was called the Disintegration Banquet. So we identified with our fellow students, with our professors, socially as well as academically. Mm-hmm. And if there, if you do talk to other Ford students, talk to some people who were in the program and people who weren't in it, and you probably find out how important it was. I know the ILS has gone through so many permutations during the God Almighty, 60 years since we did this, that it probably doesn't resemble the program. For example, when we were in it, it had no non-Western component. I've spent my professional career as a China historian. And so if I were going back to look at ILS from my professional point of view, I'd probably be appalled that they said nothing about the non-Western world. But looking back at it, that wasn't all bad either, because they didn't try to do everything, you know, and what they did, they did quite well. They did very, very well. And so it was a terrific experience and totally appropriate, so far as I'm concerned, for the Fords. Some of the people who didn't go into it, again, like my friend Charlie Holbrow, didn't go into it partly because they were seriously into science and math. ILS had no math whatsoever, and the university had no math requirement either. At least not for people. I actually got a Bachelor of Science here. For some reason, I qualified for that rather than the Bachelor of Arts. And I never took science. I've never gone beyond my high school sophomore year of plane geometry. So there was no science at all, no math at all. And the science that we had was geared toward ILS students. You know, I think probably it was a little bit, it may have been, I don't want to say this as a fact, maybe it's at least appeared to be a little bit less rigorous than the kind of science that a pre-med student might want to take, for example. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, it was just a great overall experience.
Where were your classes held?
I don't remember any class ever being held anywhere except Bascom Hall, but I think that's partly a matter of selective memory. I remember the ILS offices were in Bascom Hall. A man named Robert Pooley, I believe in the English department, was the head of ILS at that time. Herb Howe was in ILS, and a number of other people. We had a course in economics, a man named Eugene Rotwein, And as a graduate student, I was taking my first trip to East Asia and somehow or other discovered Eugene Rotwein was in Japan on a Fulbright, and he came to see me off when I left, sailed from Kobe, Japan to Taiwan. So, I mean, you know, there were the, if he hadn't been ILS, I wouldn't have thought of that, of looking him up in Japan, you know, but there was this kind of affinity. We felt very, very close to people in ILS. One more course I took, by the way, which I just want to mention, the most memorable non-ILS course that I took while I was here, certainly in my first 2 years, was in the French department. That was my language. And there was a Swiss guy named Alfred Glauser, G-L-A-U-S-E-R, who was a great, great character, great, great character. And he put on a production of Molière's Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme. We even went on the road and did it in Milwaukee. And I was a lackey. But at any rate, he was just funny and charming and gay too. But we didn't know there were such a thing as gay. Mm-hmm. But I discovered that later on. But the whole thing was just a fantastic experience. Mm-hmm.
So your campus experience didn't go any farther west than Bascom.
West
would be like the agricultural campus, Ag Hall.
Well, I remember dating women who lived in, there was a women's dormitory on the lakeside of Bascom Hill in that general direction, but I don't think I ever wandered off in that direction for anything except taking dates home. So, I don't think I ever went west of Bascom Hill. I was very much attached to the liberal arts. Mm-hmm. My major, I took a joint major, by the way, in history and in American studies. And my specialty in American studies was religion in America. Why I was interested in religion, I don't know, because I was brought up in a secular home, the kind of Jewish home where you celebrate Christmas. In a secular way, of course. And so that was my background. But for some reason, I was interested in religion in the U.S. And I wrote my graduating thesis on a book called American Freedom and Catholic Power by a man named Paul Blanchard. What we forget is, you know, there were so many people on the fundamentalist right who were appalled when Kennedy ran for president, for example. But there was a very strong liberal, secular, anti-Catholic movement during that period. People who really feared what they might have called popery, you know, in the United States, that if you let the Catholic Church exercise too much power, that it would be that they would limit freedom. So that's why the book was called American Freedom and Catholic Power. And as a kind of an ACLU liberal, as soon as I discovered this book, I was immediately suspicious of it. It appeared to me to be, you know, a bigotry under a liberal title. So I wrote a refutation of this book, which you may or may not find in the university archives. But at any rate, it was a great fun to write. So that was my one side of my academic major, and the other side was history, which I ended up doing professionally.
Mm-hmm. John, one, maybe two more things before we reach the hour mark.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So you've talked about places on campus where, you know, you hung out or near campus, so Paisanos, the Rat, even though you didn't say you hung out there, you mentioned the Rat.
Predictably, somebody like me would hang out at the Rat Skeller, mm-hmm. of course.
So I'm wondering if you want to talk a little bit more about the Rat, but maybe other places on campus where...
You know, I do not recall hanging out anywhere in particular, but I recall the Rat Skeller, of course. I don't think I could tell you anything about it that anybody couldn't tell you. But you know, I didn't appreciate fully what the student culture was at Wisconsin until I went to Harvard for graduate school. And in graduate school, I discovered I had no occasion to meet people socially who were not in my particular graduate specialty. I didn't even meet other graduate students. I just met Joseph Elder, who retired here after 50 years. Maybe you've interviewed him. Mm-hmm. And he was part of the ILS program. Introduced GLBT studies into ILS, I understand, among other things. He was at Harvard University in the regional studies program at the same time I was. Only he was regional studies / South Asia, and I was regional studies / East Asia, and I never met him, and I never could have met him. And I never met any undergraduates. And here, I could walk into the Ratzgeller, and there was George Rawick, you know, or Lauren Barrett, who were the two TAs from Merle Curdy's History of American Thought and Culture course. They were my TAs sitting there. I'd go and sit down and talk to them. Mm-hmm. We didn't have many black students at Wisconsin at that time, just a handful, but they were in the Ratzgeller. Henry Wirtis, who was, you know about Henry Wirtis, the infamous head of the Labor Youth League, he was down there. You know, so everybody was in the Ratzkeller. And of course, since I had my 18-year-old ID, I could drink 3.2 beer there if I wanted to. So the Ratzkeller was a great place. So the Union was kind of infamous for its cuisine, but we ate there a lot, I guess, because I don't remember if we had some kind of contract to eat there every day or we just went there because it was convenient and cheap, but we ate Union food. Smoky Lynx, I never heard of those before I ate the Union. Do those still exist?
I've never heard of them.
I hope not.
So, John, where did you study then?
Well, I guess I studied in my room. I really don't remember a whole lot, but insofar as I do remember studying, I must have studied in my room most of the time, wherever I happened to be living. Presumably, I was blessed with roommates who didn't, you know, give me too much interference in terms of that.
Okay. So, John, there are two more things on the topic list. I'm not sure we're going to get through both of them. One is UW-McCarthyism, and the other is the interaction between New York and Wisconsin culture and political
work. Okay, well, the interaction between New York and Wisconsin has been written about. Again, Richard Schickel has an essay, and you probably know the volume of books on the Old Left and New Left and Madison and so on. And there's a couple of things on that. There is one incident that illustrates the connection between the university and McCarthyism. And I've never seen the story told in all of its details. So do we have 10 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes?
We have, yeah.
5 anyway. Yeah. Let me tell you this story as I remember it, because it was an extremely important instance. Okay. Labor Youth League, front organization for the Young Communist League, invited a man named Abner Berry, if I recall the name correctly, who was a black man who was one of the editors for the Harlem edition of the Daily Worker. And when he was invited by this infamous left-wing organization, there was, of course, an uproar at the other end of State Street because many of Joe McCarthy's followers were sitting at their desks in State Street. Probably the fourth or fifth generation of them are still there today, but you don't have to put that in your oral history record. But at any rate, many of them were still there. They were down there then. And when they heard that the university was going to have a communist and a Daily Worker editor speaking here, and I've looked this up. This the date on this, I believe, is February 1953. There was an uproar, and they formed a committee to investigate the university. Well, Edwin B. Fred, sort of the Clark Kent of university presidents, mild, meek Edwin B. Fred, a marine biologist by training, was a staunch defender of the plaque on Bascom Hall, of the continual and fearless sifting and winnowing. and defended the university's right even to have communists speak here. So there was a great build-up to this and a lot of controversy and letters from alumni. And you'll find all this in the record somewhere. But what was really interesting are the particulars of what happened when this guy arrived to speak. It was a cold winter night. And the guy was coming up from Chicago on the Chicago and Milwaukee Railroad. And the train was 2 hours late. So we were all gathered on the south side of the of Bascom Hill. I don't remember what hall it was, but you had the... Do you still have a building on the north side of Bascom Hill with an Orozco mural in it? A very famous Orozco mural. At any rate, that was the education building at that time. And we were the opposite side. We were on the south side of Bascom Hill. And there was this huge, huge crowd there, and there were too many people, and so we overflowed the building, so we moved over to where the Orozco mural was, to the auditorium in the educational building. And we all sat patiently waiting for the guy to arrive, including, as I recall, in the very front row, people from the state legislature who were going to investigate us. Okay, so the guy arrives late, and Henry Wirtis introduces him, and he starts his speech. And he's just gotten to the line that your government in Washington, because at that time people on the far left viewed the government in Washington sort of the way people on the far right view it today, which was, this was the enemy. Your government in Washington is building concentration camps to put political prisoners in. That was the line. And at that moment, Henry Wirtis interrupted it and said, I'm terribly sorry, but there's a university regulation that we cannot continue this meeting in this building past 10 p.m. And we cannot afford to violate university regulations. So he said, I'm going to go down to the union and telephone President Fred and ask him if he'll give us a place where we can continue the meeting. So Henry Wirtis and the speaker and 200 people or whatever it was, like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, went down the hill on this freezing cold winter night, and we all stood outside of the union while Henry Wirtis went inside and phoned President Fred. And when he came out with the news that President Fred had said no. We could not continue this meeting inside of any university building. So what we did was, we walked up to the area right out in front of Science Hall. Facing Science Hall, I remember precisely where it was. It was to the left of Science Hall as you face it. There's an area sufficient for, what was it, 50 or 100 people, I guess, standing out there by that time. And we continued. And Mr. Berry, if I remember his name correctly, continued and went on from where he had left off and continued his talk, and then it was open for questions and answers. And he was destroyed. He hadn't done his homework. If there were concentration camps, because that was one of the first questions, you know, document your accusation about concentration camps. He couldn't do it. And here was this communist speaker from the Daily Worker who was being destroyed in open debate, open discussion, by a group of faculty, students, townspeople, and state legislators on the university grounds. So the committee to investigate the university became the committee to support the university. You look it up. It may not have been the exact title, but that is what happened. The whole thing was transformed. And it was a kind of like a Wizard of Oz story. Everything, you know, in this crazy, crazy land. So that's what happened. And I was there from beginning to end. I don't know if I was doing the story for the Cardinal or whether somebody else was doing it. But you'll find this all written up in the Cardinal and certainly in the Cap Times. So at any rate, this would, but this is very important because, of course, Wisconsin, there were only two university campuses at that time that had chapters of the Labor Youth League. One was Wisconsin, the other, I believe, was Oberlin. And when Wirtus and Arnie Lieber, who were the two Ford, New York Jewish Ford students who were running this organization, when they graduated with me in 1955, people say that the Labor Youth League, or maybe the Communist Party itself, ordered somebody to transfer from Oberlin to come here to run the organization. And a year later, also orders from above, it was abolished. So it didn't last all that long. But while it was here, it served a function, and one was inadvertently to reaffirm the Wisconsin tradition of open dialogue. And incidentally, I knew Henry Wirtus casually, the way I knew all the Ford students. But I remember once he said, "John, how would you like to join a Marxist study group?" And I'm not into theory. I'm not a theory kind of person. So more on those grounds than on political grounds, I said, "I don't really think I have the time," so I never did that. But at any rate, this is part of the scene.
Well, John, I need to wrap up. As I say, I always reserve the right to do a follow-up interview if we can make that happen. But this concludes this interview with John Israel. John, thank you for your time.
Fine. Roy, thank you very much.